From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Barbecue season is upon us, and so we're devoting today's episode to the pit, the fire, the smoke, and to those who have mastered this ancient craft. And before we get to the meat, we start with a little history. In his latest book, Black Smoke, food scholar Adrian Miller writes, quote, "Black-run barbecue joints often find themselves located at the intersection of food, race, and absurdity."
Barbecue was one of the places where people kind of ignored the color line in terms of restaurants. So you would often find whites going into the black neighborhood to get barbecue.
I don't think I'm alone when I say I've been waiting for Adrian's book for a long time. From the surprising and often overlooked beginnings of American barbecue, Adrian chronicles the evolution and the entrepreneurship of black barbecue as he stokes the coals of its living legacy. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, good to be with you.
Let's start at the beginning with the word, which has its roots in West Africa. Can you explain how barbecue's history starts with the indigenous people of the Americas and then the primary cooking techniques that were used?
Yeah, and the reason I start with the indigenous people in the Americas, mainly mainland North America, is the Caribbean origin story never really quite gelled for me when it came to Southern barbecue. Because that story is that Europeans show up in the Caribbean, they see indigenous people cooking in a way they're not familiar with, and then Europeans bring that to the North American mainland. And, you know, the way that Southern barbecue emerges is just so different from the way that at least what the Europeans observed in the Caribbean was. So I argue that really it was a fusion of Native American kind of smoking techniques. And there were multiple ways that Native Americans were cooking. So in some senses, they were having sticks that were aimed towards the fire, and there would be morsels of meat kind of angled toward the fire for cooking. There was spit cooking, which Europeans would have been familiar with. There was also something called an earth oven. So it was really like a vertical hole with a fuel source in the bottom and then layers of meat and vegetation. And then you bury it and then come back at some time later and eat that. There was also kind of the raised platform, which is what people saw in the Caribbean. And then also a very shallow pit, which a lot of times the meat was just laid right on the burning coals. And so what I argue is that Europeans saw some of this and then added their own grilling techniques, and that put us on the road to barbecue. And then later, when enslaved Africans increase in number, they become barbecue's principal cooks and add their own kind of culinary signature to what would become barbecue.
So talk a little more about that transition.
What surprised me in researching this book is that Native Americans were the first barbecue cooks, really, and that they were enslaved as well. So the earliest forms of barbecue were probably cooked by enslaved Native Americans and white indentured servants before the transition to African slavery. So then when enslaved Africans are asked to cook this way, they start to meld their own kind of meat cooking and smoking traditions from West Africa with European grilling techniques and what Native Americans were doing. And it becomes this kind of unique thing. So a lot of people in the time of colonial America called barbecue cooking the Indian way. And what you find is there's some African-American barbecuers well into the 20th century who still described this kind of old school barbecue as cooking the Indian way. And that was digging a trench a few feet wide, a few feet deep, filling it with hardwood coals that were burned down, and then taking whole animal carcasses. So that could be a pig, sheep. If they did a cow, they would usually quarter it because cows are so big. Butterflying them, sticking poles in the side of them, and then somebody flipped those carcasses regularly to cook them without burning and then added sauce throughout the process. And so that was what barbecue was originally in terms of like Southern barbecue.
How did it figure into antebellum social life?
So in the early years, especially in Virginia, I agree with some scholars that Virginia is really the birthplace of Southern barbecue. Early on, it was really small gatherings, usually wealthy people getting together. And then the other side of barbecue was kind of rowdy parties where usually dudes got together, shotguns, gambled, played games, told lies, all that kind of stuff. And then over time, as barbecue becomes more popular, politicians and preachers get a hold of it and supersize it. So by the time we get to the 1820s and 30s, we're seeing reports of barbecues with 10, 20, 50,000 people. And I think barbecue was perfect for these events because it was so scalable. As long as you had enough labor, and usually that's why they turned to enslaved people, because they could make them do this work. As long as you had enough labor, enough animals, and enough space, you could pull off a barbecue.
Barbecue, like church, you say, is about building community. So can you talk about the relevance one has to the other, and in particular, this phrase, theological barbecue?
Yeah, so in kind of the religious awakening period in the United States, you had these things called revivals or camp meetings. And so these would be multiple day affairs where they were preaching all day long and then they were eating at certain breaks. And barbecue fit well to that because, again, it was scalable and you could feed a lot of people. And so that was a way to draw a crowd and hopefully get converts to your religion. But on the plantations, enslaved African-Americans also used barbecue to build church in a very small sense. And so usually enslaved people had the weekends off, especially the Sabbath. And with the work schedule slowed, that gave time to barbecue. There were also reports of secret barbecues where enslaved people would kind of, quote unquote, borrow a pig and cook it out of the sight of the slaveholder. And a lot of times those were religious gatherings as well. And so you get this connection to church and barbecue, both in the private kind of small gatherings on the plantation and also these grand, larger kind of big scale public events called camp meetings.
One of the most powerful parts of your book are just the numerous profiles of these legendary figures of Black barbecue that everyone should know. Could you just tell us some stories about some of these people?
Yeah, you know, that was one of the most fun parts of researching this book. So a couple people who come to mind. One is a woman named Marie Jean. That would have been her French name. She was also known as Mary John. But she was a woman in Arkansas Post, which was one of the earliest European settlements in what we now call Arkansas. And in the 1840s, there are newspaper reports of this enslaved African-American woman being what we would call a pitmaster. Back then, they called it superintending. And so they talked about her being in charge of these big barbecues. So, I mean, just think of that. Enslaved Black woman, in charge of barbecue, telling dudes what to do. Eventually, she buys her freedom and runs a restaurant in Arkansas Post. And when she dies in the 1850s, the local newspaper eulogized her and really celebrated her cooking. So I just think that's a remarkable story. And it shows you that at least in African-American circles, women were in the barbecue game going way back. Another guy that I loved to write about was a guy named Columbus B. Hill, who shows up in my home state of Colorado in the 1870s. And by the 1880s, he's on regularly doing barbecues for 5,000 to 10,000 people. So on July 4th, 1890, when the cornerstone for the Colorado State Capitol was laid, he did a barbecue for 25,000 people in front of the Capitol.
So fascinating. Could you share another profile with us?
Yeah. So another woman who was very interesting was a woman named Ernestine Vandeval. And she was from Nicodemus, Kansas. And if people don't know about Nicodemus, they should spend some time getting to know about it. It's one of the oldest all-Black communities in the U.S. And it was started by a group of people called Exodusters. And these were people who left the South for better opportunities right after slavery ended, so right after emancipation. And she grows up in this community and she moves to California and she ends up running a barbecue and soul food joint in Pasadena, which was beloved. Evidently, Walt Disney loved her food. And she ends up later in life returning to Nicodemus and opens a barbecue restaurant there, which still exists to this day. And her niece runs it now because Miss Vandeval died several years ago. So her niece, Angela Bates, runs this place. So every summer, usually the last weekend in July or first weekend in August, Nicodemus has what it calls homecoming days. And so any living descendant or, you know, person who used to live in Nicodemus, they come back to this community and it's a big party and anybody is welcome. And Angela Bates opens up the restaurant and serves up some very tasty ribs.
Wow. How and when did barbecue move into, quote, mainstream America?
So I argue that it moved into mainstream America in the 20th century. And a lot of this was due to the transition from rural barbecue to urban barbecue. So rural barbecue was whole animal cooking over a trench filled with hardwood burning coals. But when you get to an urban environment, that's not always so practical. And so we get the construction of artificial pits. The early pits were usually brick or cinder block. And then we start to see, instead of whole animal cooking, people focusing on parts of animals. So that's when you start to see ribs, pork shoulder, sausages, chicken, all of that kind of grow in popularity. And then it leads to innovation in the various regional styles that we argue about today.
So this notion of, quote, legit, unquote, black barbecue businesses, to, you know, that they're supposed to look run down, and then the relationship between the owners and operators to their white customers. Could you speak about that and the evolution of black barbecue as a business?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So, you know, this idea that a barbecue place is supposed to look a certain way speaks to kind of the discrimination that black entrepreneurs have faced, you know, from the very beginning in this country. And that main thing is the lack of access to capital. So when black barbecuers wanted to start a business, especially a barbecue business, and that was one of the most popular businesses to start, they would usually just dig a hole in the ground and do the old trench method. So you had people running places out in the country, you know, there would be a designated spot, or they would do it from their lawn on their house. But when people started to look for brick and mortar locations, they just never got a nice spot on the main business thoroughfare. So it usually was in a rundown part of town, and usually the building itself was rundown. And because of a lack of access to capital, these entrepreneurs really could not, you know, improve the physical plant of their restaurant. So that became kind of an aesthetic norm. And people loved what these entrepreneurs were cooking, but, you know, they would just say, oh, these are the signs of a good place. But that was really a reflection that a large number of these entrepreneurs never got enough money to really shore up all those other aspects of their business and beautify it.
You have a tongue-in-cheek recipe for disappearing black barbecue. When did the shift in media's coverage of the brilliance of black barbecue to its exclusion occur?
I peg it to the 1990s. And I think the big thing that changed was the rise of this group that we call foodies. So we've always had people who kind of looked at food as leisure and sport, but they tended to be very wealthy. But what happens with foodies in the late 1980s and then the early 1990s is you've got a group of middle-class people who've got disposable income. Their palate is much more adventurous than their parents, and they're looking for authentic experiences. And just as this group rises, you have a commensurate rise in food media to cater this group. And so barbecue was growing in popularity around the same time. So foodies wanted to know, hey, what is barbecue and where can I get the good stuff? And unfortunately, because the people who decide what stories get told were not diverse, more and more white people were put forth as experts. Because the people who were looking for stories would just ask other white people, yeah, who should we profile? Who should we, you know, talk about?
Who is out there that you want us to know about?
One guy is Matt Horn. He's in Oakland, and he's on the way to opening up the brick and mortar spot. It's kind of hard to do that these days. There's another guy, and I'm sorry, I don't remember his name, but I remember the restaurant is called Veg Mob, because vegan barbecue is pretty hot trend right now. And so I want folks to know about them. Also, if you haven't seen Queer Eye, the Jones sisters in Kansas City, Kansas, great people doing great food. Their sauce business has taken off after being on that show. And then the coolest thing about them, or one of the cool things, but I just love this. They have a barbecue vending machine. So 24/7, you can just show up and get sandwiches or whatever. I just think that's brilliant.
Well, Adrian, what a pleasure. And I just look forward to so many sessions with this book, reading all the stories.
Well, thank you so much.
Adrian Miller is a certified Kansas City Barbecue Society judge and a recipient of a James Beard Foundation Book Award for Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time. We've been discussing barbecue and his latest work, Black Smoke. Our barbecue show continues with one of the most famous masters of the craft, Rodney Scott, is with us next. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Rodney Scott is all about a very particular kind of barbecue, the kind that involves cooking a whole hog, a deep craft that can take a lifetime to perfect. He says that one of the great things about whole hog barbecue is that it takes so long, you naturally gather around the pit with good friends and fellowship. It strikes me that Rodney has constructed a life of good friends and fellowship, so at this point, the hog might just be the connective tissue. Hi, Rodney.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. I'm really happy to get to talk to you. Can you describe the serving and eating of whole hog barbecue?
The serving and eating of whole hog barbecue is somewhat of a gathering, a party where everybody gets to see the whole hog finishes up with the mob, the seasoning. And lots of people are standing around, and if it's allowed by the pit master, everybody pulls from their favorite part of the hog, or the pit master himself or herself will pull from the hog and present it to the guests.
So how many hours does it take to get to the place where you can serve it and eat it?
To get a hog to where it's ready to serve, it takes about a 12-hour cooking process. 12 hours to make sure that all the fat is rendered and the hams and shoulders are cooked all the way through.
And how old were you when you first started being sort of brought into this special cult?
Well, it seems as if I was raised in this special cult, the barbecue. The very first time that I was able to put my hands on a hog was about 11 years old. And I went full-time cooking hogs every week when I was about 17 years old.
And give us an idea of your parents' place, where it's located, what it looks like from the road.
My parents' place is located in the rural area of Williamsburg County, which is right outside of the town of Hemingway. And it's a two-way highway that runs for miles. And it's a little roadside general store with a pit built on the side of it where we do all of the cooking of the hogs. So it's kind of like an old-time general store with a barbecue pit off to the side.
And what state are we in?
My parents' state of South Carolina is where my parents' store is located.
You grew up in a way that is not familiar to most of us who have lived our lives in the city. What was your family's philosophy?
My family's philosophy was if you're big enough to work, you went to work. And if it was from picking up tobacco leaves all the way up into cutting wood, cooking hogs, farming, driving tractors, whatever you were big enough to do, that's what you did. And my family's philosophy is if you don't work, you don't have fun, you don't play. This is pretty much the life of the country when you're a young kid out in the rural farm areas. You would pretty much have to do whatever you're big enough to do. In my case, 6 years old, driving a tractor up and down a tobacco field.
So what I find so interesting is that, so you worked on your family's farms, you worked in the stores, and you also worked the pit for your father's business. And then when you graduated from high school, you watched as friends maybe left the area or started having a different kind of life, and yet you stayed. What kept you in the same place for so long?
One of the things that kept me in the same place was I didn't really have much of a choice at the time. Working at the family business was my dad's plan for me. And at the time, I had no other ideas, no other thoughts of what I was going to do other than work. And it was kind of a procrastination of me saying, you know, I'll think about it next year. Maybe I'll think about it in a couple of years. That was the kind of thoughts that I would have. So, you know, in constantly procrastinating that, I basically ended up just doing the same thing.
Doing the same thing, but that's the kind of thing that the more you do it, the more you perfect it, right?
Yes. At the time, I wasn't aware of that. But yeah, the more you do it, the more you learn about it.
How long did you work there with your dad?
I worked with my dad from 1989 up until 2016.
That is a long time.
Yeah.
And in your book, Rodney Scott's World of Barbecue, of course, there are recipes. There are gorgeous photographs of food. But you also made the decision to go public and talk about the rupture that you had with your dad and that part of the family. I can't imagine how painful that was.
Wow. You know, that's one of the most painful things any individual can go through. In carrying that emotion around for the years that I did, I've had to carry it. It's been from 2016 up until the day that I finally said, I'm going to put this on paper and say it out loud. That was a day of relief. That was a day of kind of standing up straight, so to speak, because you got that load off your shoulders.
How did your life change? What enabled you to make the leap to leave and then open your own place in Charleston in the city?
Well, you know, the opportunity came about maybe 6 to 8 months before me and my dad finally decided to go our separate ways. And I said I would take a chance and see how it worked out. And the one thing that gave me comfort on even just taking the chance was the fact that I had home to fall back on if it didn't work out. And once me and my dad kind of separated, that was the finishing sign for me to say, I'm going to go ahead and try this and I'm going to make sure it works. I feel like if I survive at least a year, I'll be okay.
The book isn't only your personal story. It's also recipes and instructions for building a cinder block pit. What would you say to someone who has your book and is going to attempt a whole hog for the very first time?
One of the things I would say to someone who has the book and going to attempt that whole hog is thank you for purchasing the book. When you're putting this pit together, you definitely want to put it in a place that's safe. You know, you don't want to put it in dry leaves or anything like that. You want to have fun with it. You want to invite all of your friends and neighbors that you really like over and go through this experience. You should make it a pit party, is what I like to say, where you don't do it alone. You call people over and yeah, everybody load the pit, build the pit together, load the hog on the pit, cook it, sit around and fellowship until it's done. And then we all eat.
I have to say that I was really grateful that I had ordered some local barbecue the day before I started reading your book. It would have been really, really torture to not have that aroma around. Thank you so much, Rodney.
Thank you. The pleasure was all mine.
That's Rodney Scott, a man who knows his barbecue. His book, co-written with Lolis Eric Eli, is Rodney Scott's World of Barbecue. We go from South Carolina to Texas by way of California. Barbecue is an obsessive craft. Just ask Michelle Munoz. Her husband Andrew's obsession with barbecue started as a hobby, blossomed into a backyard pop-up, and has now become a family affair and full-blown business. Moose Craft Barbecue is on the precipice of opening their first brick-and-mortar in Los Angeles. And the duo behind it join us for this week's In the Weeds.
Hi, my name is Andrew Munoz, and I'm the co-owner of Moose Craft Barbecue.
My name is Michelle Munoz, and I am the co-owner of Moose Craft Barbecue.
I found my way to barbecue through my day job. I used to report into Texas about 3 times a quarter, sometimes more. And on my off time, I would explore the city. And my father-in-law had always told me, if you're ever in Texas, try the barbecue. I hear it's fantastic. And so I did, and I was instantly hooked. So I would barbecue in my backyard just to kind of hang out and, you know, clear my mind. And over time, we started getting a little bit better, and I just kind of wanted to cook every weekend. So if a friend or family member was having a birthday party or just like coming over to hang out, I would always want to bring like ribs or something barbecue just to have an excuse to make it. And
I thought he was crazy obsessed with it. But at the same time, I was intrigued and I wanted to learn more about it.
So a few years in, we kind of saw like this underground food movement happening like through social media. And my wife came up with this idea to like, hey, let's host a pop-up in our backyard once we, you know, like have a certain amount of followers. And so that's what we did. And fast forward a couple of years, we gained steam and some momentum, and we had a pretty good following, and it was actually very consuming. And we had to decide, were we going to pursue this or, you know, just say it was fun. It was a fun thing that we did. And I happened to get laid off at the same time we were making that decision. And so it made it easier for us. And it was like, well, I don't really want to stay in the corporate world. So this is kind of like, let's try this. And if it doesn't work out, then we'll go back to what we were doing. And thankfully it's worked out for us. So we were in our backyard, I would say no more than 6 months. We had done a number of pop-ups, and we started getting some local press, and we had a few write-ups. And once the write-ups happened, the lines kind of got longer. And I remember one weekend going to my front yard to see if anyone had come yet, because we were about 15 to 20 minutes before we were scheduled to kind of start. And one of my old coworkers was standing at the corner of our parking lot. And I was like, oh, cool, you're the first one here. And he was like, no, dude, like, you have a line down the block. And I went around the corner of our fence. It's a high fence, so you can't really see to the side. And sure enough, there was a line going like three or four houses down. And I made everybody come into the backyard. And we did that event. And then we decided, you know what, we can't do this at home anymore. So we reached out to local breweries and started doing a brewery kind of circuit for about a year and a half. And we went into Smorgasburg at the beginning of 2019. We do Texas-style barbecue. We use offset smokers primarily. So it's essentially a large cylinder propane tank, or people use like air water tanks. But it's the key to it is it's a thick steel cylinder. And then there's an offset tank that's welded on the bottom. So you feed it fire. And the key to it is just really good fire management, not rushing the process. And, you know, cooking your meats nice, low, and slow for a number of hours. So because we do Texas-style barbecue, the main protein that we do is brisket. And then I would say it would be ribs and sausage. So the Texas Trinity. And for us, the briskets take roughly anywhere between 14 and 16 hours if you kind of hold the momentum and cook it right. And, you know, so if you fluctuate or if you lose track of something, it could take longer. So the goal is to kind of really sit there and watch your fires and make sure that it's doing what you want it to do so that you can kind of get it done when you need to get it done.
We were born and raised Angeleno, so we like to add that Cali-Mex twist to our menu. And that's where we bring something a little different than just your traditional Texas-style barbecue. For example, our sausages are handcrafted. We use the trimmings from our briskets and our pork ribs to create our sausages. And a lot of the recipes that we do include a lot of Mexican influence. So you'll get a lot of those Mexican herbs and chilies and dried chilies and fire-roasted poblanos. Our esquites are a play of a Mexican street food, corn on the cob. And esquites, basically what it is the kernels off the cob served into either a cup or a bowl and prepared the same way a Mexican street corn would be. So it would be, you know, your mayonnaise, your cotija, your special blend of chilies and spices, some lime for a little acidity. And it's our take on a traditional creamed corn, but it's the creamed corn that we grew up eating in the streets of Los Angeles, the cream corn that we enjoyed hearing the paletero coming down the street honking his horn. And so we wanted to incorporate that style into our menu.
So the plan with our current brick and mortar, we were fortunate enough to find a second generation restaurant. So the infrastructure is already in place, and all we had to do was, painting, kind of put our branding inside and outside of the building, and essentially just buy all of our in-kitchen restaurant like tools, so pots, pans, shelving for the walk-in fridge and freezer. So it wasn't cheap, but it was something that we were able to afford on our own without taking on any investors. We did set up a GoFundMe because jumping into this, we kind of budgeted for a lot of things, but we didn't anticipate the cost of transferring permits into our name and setting up appliances with the utilities with the city. And so they were multiple thousands of dollars, and we were just like, whoa, that was a lot more than we were thinking. So yeah, our GoFundMe is still active, and we still get donations trickling in here and every other week or so.
So our menu is set up where it's family style. You order meat market style. So everything, all the meats are sold by weight, by pound. And my recommendation is to try a little bit of everything. Andrew mentioned earlier, we do our Texas Trinity, which is, brisket, ribs, and sausage. But we also have delicious smoked turkey, pulled pork. Every once in a while on a special, we do pastrami. We also do beef cheeks. Everything is served family style and on a tray. It's meant to be shared with family and friends. So my recommendation when you come and visit us at Moose, try a little bit of everything. It's also delicious and unique.
Andrew and Michelle Munoz are the husband and wife team behind Moose Craft Barbecue. Keep an eye out for their brick and mortar spot opening in Lincoln Heights. In a minute, eating meat has never been more complicated. And while many see a plant-based diet as the answer, our next guest believes sustainable ranching is a better solution for the planet and those of us who live here. We hear from the author of Defending Beef next. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. I can remember when dinner in America overwhelmingly meant beef at the center of the plate. Now it's easy to demonize the meat due to concerns over animal welfare, climate change, ecological impacts, and human health. But as with most issues involving humans and the planet, things are more complex and nuanced than most want to hear. Rancher and environmental lawyer Nicolette Hahn-Nyman finds herself once again in the role of defending beef. Hi, Nicolette.
Hello.
So you've been involved in how the beef industry slams up against ecological health for decades. What was your first involvement with these issues?
Well, I started to be a vegetarian when I was in college. And so I'd been a vegetarian for about 10 years and was working as an environmental lawyer for National Wildlife Federation and was hired by Bobby Kennedy Jr. to be the senior attorney at his environmental group called Waterkeeper Alliance. And he asked me to focus my time entirely on pollution from the meat industry. And originally, I kind of thought, well, this is perfect because, I'm a vegetarian. I already kind of think it's bad. meat is kind of bad in all kinds of different ways. And this will just reinforce, my own beliefs that I've already had for a long time. And so I started, at his request, kind of began this national effort to reform the meat industry, the industrialized way of doing it, which was causing a lot of pollution and causing a lot of problems from an animal welfare perspective, human health perspective, et cetera, especially water pollution issues. And pretty quickly into that project, I started to feel that there were very, very different ways of raising animals for food. And I was spending some time on really good farms where I was seeing animals having a very good life. And I was meeting farmers that had good lives, working with their animals and taking really good care of the land, just a really responsible stewardship on the one hand. And then I was also spending time in these large concentrated industrial facilities. And to me, they just couldn't have been more different. And so I began, you know, advocating within the Waterkeeper group that we needed to make a big distinction between those different types of meat production. And even though I didn't start eating meat again, I sort of became a meat advocate to a degree, because I was really interested in making this, you know, difference of sort of well-raised animals that produce healthy meat and, you know, are good for the planet, and then the industrial things that I think, you know, we kind of really should all be against.
I've always thought that cows are miraculous. They eat grass, which humans can't digest, and in doing so, they're essentially turning sunlight into protein. Can you expand on the link between grasslands, soil, and range animals?
Yes. But I should add that after leaving the Waterkeeper Alliance job, I married Bill Nyman, the founder of the Nyman Ranch Meat Company, and moved to a ranch in California. And so for the last 18 years, I've actually been living and working on a ranch. And so I've gotten that sort of other side of the perspective on, you know, the meat industry and raising animals. And I think the most important thing for people to realize is that the vast majority of the land that cattle and other grazing animals actually around the world are on is land that cannot be used to grow crops. So the ranch that I live on in Northern California, in Marin County, is a good example of that. We're right on the ocean. It's very windy here and cool, and it really is a natural grassland area that was created a long time ago by wild grazing animals. And the miraculous thing about cattle, as you said, is that they can just basically eat this very low quality vegetation that is kind of covering a huge portion of the earth. And it would be there, you know, regardless of whether or not there's an animal eating it. But the cattle or other grazing animals, they come in and they move through grassland areas. They subsist almost entirely on inedible vegetation like grass. And then that's sort of a conversion process. By eating that grass, they, you know, build their own bodies. It's sort of a very complex digestive tract that they have, which allows them, with the cooperation of a lot of microorganisms that live in their, you know, multi-chambered ruminant digestive tract. And it turns this thing that, you know, humans cannot eat into food, basically, that humans can consume, and is really valuable food, actually. And then the other part that's so interesting about it is that that action that they're having on the land with their hooves and with their mouths and with their manure is they're actually sort of enhancing the biological life of that whole system. And where you have grazing animals, especially if they're well managed, there's really good research from all over the world showing that you have more vegetative growth, you have more water that's held in the soil. And so because there's more vegetation growing there, there's more underground growth happening as well. And so there's more biological activity down in the soil, microorganisms and worms and insects and all kinds of other things. And there's a very complex set of things happening underground that are basically taking the energy of the sun and bringing carbon down in through the plant and getting that into the soil. And that's that carbon sequestration process that a lot of people are talking about nowadays. So grazing animals are very closely linked to healthy soil. And there's a really positive ecological impact for grazing animals when they're well raised.
What is ecologically optimal agriculture? How does it mirror nature? And what needs to happen for it to exist at a scale to make a real difference?
Yeah, well, I really think that is the crux. To me, that is the challenge that humans are facing right now. It's how do we make agriculture look more like nature? We have to look at this holistically and think about what belongs in what location. My husband Bill likes to call it the right locale. Not necessarily just focusing on local, because I think having local and regional food systems is desirable, and we want to try to do that as much as possible. But when you're talking about things like beef, for example, you often have large open grazing areas or grasslands that really benefit from the presence of grazing animals. And a lot of times, like in the western part of the United States, for example, a lot of the best grazing areas are really remote from human populations. So it makes sense to have grazing animals in those Western grasslands. And that's true of lots of other parts of the world as well, not just the U.S. But an overall view of ecological food production tries to think about how nature works, and in any kind of farming or ranching situation is trying to sort of look more like natural systems. So it's moving away from singular inputs and singular production systems and trying to create more complex systems where you're having, you know, for example, multiple different things being produced on any given piece of land where there's agriculture, and having animals and plants and fungi really all working together. So I don't mean just necessarily like you're raising mushrooms for food or something like that, but the whole subterranean environment that we were talking about before, a lot of the transactions that happen on the microscopic level are actually fungal microorganisms. So the fungi are important too, and the plants are important, and the animals are important. And what I think the cornerstone of ecologically optimal food production is thinking and understanding that complexity and understanding how, you know, how can we produce food using nature's amazingly wise systems.
With the words plant-based diet seemingly everywhere, I'm curious what you think about faux meat and why you consider them a distraction.
Yeah, this is one of the things I added to the new version of Defending Beef that's just coming out, because there's so much discussion about this and there's so much money being invested into these, you know, various different types of ways to produce alternatives to meat. And, you know, I was a vegetarian for 33 years, so I certainly have no objection to people not eating meat or even being vegan. But I've always felt that the cornerstone of healthy food is real food and healthy diets, you know, and good human health over the long term. And what really troubles me about a lot of these new faux meats is they're really highly processed foods. The sort of bottom line is that the more I've learned and read and studied, and in my own life as well, I think that the crux of healthy food is real food.
Well, thank you so much, Nicolette.
Well, thank you for asking me. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
That was writer, environmental activist, lawyer, and cattle rancher Nicolette Hahn-Nyman. She recently updated her book, Defending Beef, in a new edition that comes out next month. One of my longtime favorite practitioners of sustainable meat butchery is located at the 4th Street Market in downtown Santa Ana. Electric City practices whole animal butchery and takes pride in sourcing from small, family-owned California farms and ranches that are all focused on sustainable agriculture. Gabriela Gomez is a butcher there, and she joins us with some ideas on what to slap in your grill this weekend and all summer long. Hi, Gabriela.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I am wonderful.
Tell me a bit about yourself. How did you come to be a butcher?
Well, butchery has kind of always been part of my life. One of my first memories as a kid is helping my mom like harvest the chickens in our backyard. When I was in high school, I was part of a culinary team, and our teacher would have us fabricating chickens after school like every day. Once I graduated high school, butchery was actually one of the first jobs that I applied to. I tried going to three or four different shops, and, you know, every time I got kind of the same look where it was like, are you sure you know what you're getting into? And, you know, I totally get it. Like a 5'2" little girl walking into a shop full of, you know, 40-year-old men who are 6'4", 6'5". I'm sure it looked a little interesting. So, you know, sadly, it didn't happen. I ended up going through the restaurant industry. I worked in Michelin-starred restaurants. And, you know, the more I worked in the restaurant industry, the more I kind of realized that there was a really big lack of connection with, you know, where our meat comes from, where our protein comes from. There's so much waste in kitchens. And it was, like, really heartbreaking as someone who, like, grew up, you know, using the entire animal and not just the fancy cuts. So when I left New York, it was right when COVID hit. And I came back to Orange County, and Electric City happened to post that they were looking to hire somebody. And, you know, I immediately was like, oh, my goodness, this is my chance to get back, you know, to something that I've always wanted to do. And I think because of, you know, all the restaurant experience that I had, Michael, the owner, was really enthusiastic about giving me a chance. And I've been with him ever since.
I have to ask you, what high school did you go to that you were fabricating chickens?
I went to Newport Harbor over in Newport Beach. And shout out to Mrs. Dukes. She was one of the most dedicated teachers, was really, really, really involved with her students and, you know, would take us out to restaurants, took us to Las Vegas to like have an experience there with Le Cordon Bleu. She was very involved with all of her students, specifically the competition team. We went out to Kansas. We won our state competition, and then we got third place in nationals. And it was probably one of the best experiences that I've ever had.
Wow. So tell me a little bit about Electric City Butcher and the owner, Michael.
So what I absolutely love about Electric City Butcher is just kind of everything that they stand for, not just quality, not just transparency, but like responsible sourcing, having the connection with our farmers, the amount of effort they put into the sourcing, making sure that it's all here, you know, California. We know it's going from their actual farm to a processor back to us. There's no one else that gets involved with it. Right now, we're receiving either primals or half animals, and just having that connection with what we're, you know, giving to our guests, it just brings a whole other dimension that I think is really lost, not just in grocery stores, but even in most butcher shops.
So this episode that I'm talking to you for is all about barbecue. If I were to walk into Electric City today and ask for your favorite cut to throw on the grill, what would it be and why?
I mean, my favorite cuts are obviously always going to be like our thick cut porterhouse T-bones. Our bone and ribeyes are just insane. My other favorite cut that is often kind of forgotten about or kind of like the stepchild of these very well-known steaks is sirloins. A thick cut sirloin gets a great char, sliced out. It's just unbeatable.
Okay, so now that you've whet our appetites with steak, let's move on to something that I imagine allows you a bit more creativity, and that is sausages.
Yeah, I mean, sausage is one of the cornerstones of the shop. I really got to kind of put together the sausages for this last Cinco de Mayo menu that we had. So the street corn sausage was probably my first from start to finish, like creatively inputting that into our system as one of our new staple sausages.
Oh, how fun. So what is in that one?
So the street corn sausage is roasted corn. It's going to have cotija cheese, cilantro, and a couple different spices in there. But it has, you know, all those flavor profiles of what you would get off of, you know, the street corn that we all love.
That sounds so good. I heard that you also did a Mardi Gras sausage.
Yeah. So, I mean, that sausage was a really fun one. It was based off of the Sazerac cocktail. So that Sazerac sausage was Michael's idea. He had spent some time down in Louisiana, and, you know, it's one of their classic cocktails.
So once we have our sausages, what should we know about treating them well so they're not incinerated and they don't burst before we get them into our mouths?
So, I mean, with any other great sausage, I mean, it really is up to the person. My favorite way of cooking sausage is beer, like letting it boil out in beer for about 2 to 3 minutes, letting it drain, and then either really nice hot grill or a cast iron also works great. Or there's a different approach where you sear off your sausage first, like in a cast iron or skillet. Once you got really nice color on the outside, add about a quarter cup of liquid, whether you want to do just water. Again, you could do beer, that always works great. Cover, let that cook for about 3 to 4 minutes, and then just make sure that the internal temperature is at 145, and boom, good to go.
Yeah, because I think people have gotten so used to pre-cooked sausages from supermarkets that they forget how to actually cook a sausage that is raw.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest issue that I've seen people have is overcooking their sausage. And that's one of the things where, you know, having a thermometer on hand is going to be your best friend.
Well, it's been really lovely to meet you. Thank you so much for coming to the show.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been awesome.
That was Gabriela Gomez, a butcher at Electric City Butcher in Santa Ana. The market report is next. Stay close. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. It's time for the weekly market report. Jillian Ferguson is at the Santa Monica Market now with this report.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I'm here at the market this morning with Deb McHale, who many of you might remember from her pop-up series, Logma, where she was focused on live fire cooking. But these days, Deb is cooking under the name Chef Deb. She's doing a lot of private events and more focused on the Persian recipes that she grew up with. Hi, Deb.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So we're here in that sort of in-between season. It's not quite summer. We're coming out of spring. What's catching your eye today?
So today I really love the potatoes at Finley Farms. He's my favorite farmer at the farmer's market. Everything they grow is pretty amazing, but their potatoes are really, really rad. So I'm making sala diluvia. In Persian tradition, it's traditionally eaten as an appetizer with like bread or kuku. But the way I'm going to do it is I'll boil the potatoes, blanch them, and then dice them up, make like a lemon aioli, throw some peas, some poached chicken, maybe some fresh parsley and a little bit of dill, and just serve it up with some veggies and some sangak bread and enjoy it. But these potatoes are just out of this world, and they're only here for, I think, a couple of weeks.
So tell us what makes these particular potatoes so special.
Well, I think we're going to have to ask Brandon about that if we can get him on an interview. I know he's just like...
He's very shy.
He's very shy and just super, super humble. But their skins are like have barely formed, and they're super, like when you cook them, not only are they sweet, but they're like a very light mineral flavor. So it tastes like a potato should taste. Sometimes when you take a potato and you smell it and it has that smell, it doesn't necessarily taste like it. Or it could be like almost astringent and like make you kind of like go like that on the back of your palate. But his are just, they're so well balanced.
And so when you're describing this dish, there's so many different components to it. Is the chicken mixed in? Is it like what we would call a potato salad?
Yeah, yeah. So the word comes from, it's actually a French word, salade olivier. In France, they also have the salad, but it's like super mayo-based, and sometimes you can put carrots in it. Something that that Persians do is we put khyarshur, which is also known as Armenian pickles or Persian pickles. So it has like a little bit of acidity. The way I serve it is I take I'll make it family style, and I'll take a little scoop, I'll put it on a plate or like a low shallow bowl, serve it with olive, like really good, I'm really into estronel olive oil, it's a Spanish olive oil, and it works really well with this dish, and I'll sprinkle some fresh cracked pepper and some herbs and just enjoy it, and it's so much sustenance, and it's so good for you.
This sounds great. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you.
That was Chef Deb McHale with some great ideas for new potatoes. You can find what she's up to on her website, Chef Deb. That's chefdebb.com. Or you can follow her on Instagram at Deb_McHale. That's Deb_MICHAIL. Dawn Birch, along with her husband James, are the farmers behind Florabella Farms up in Three Rivers, which is right at the entrance of Sequoia National Park. And Dawn, you are also bringing new potatoes here to the market. I'm looking at two in your hands, both a little bigger, about tennis ball size. Tell us what's so special about fresh potatoes that are coming out of the ground right now.
Well, actually, I don't think most people have ever tasted a fresh potato. They're a lot more flavorful. I think often people think a potato tastes like what you put on it, the sour cream or the butter or the salt and the pepper. These potatoes, I actually eat them with nothing on them because they have their own flavor and they're fantastic. And the way you can recognize a really fresh potato out of the ground is the skin, because when potatoes are first harvested, they grow underneath the ground. On the tip of each root of the plant, there will be a potato. And when they come out of the ground, they don't have skin on them. They're naked. And they have to sit for a few days to form their skin. And when you see a potato and the skin's flaking a little bit, and you rub your thumb on it and the skin kind of peels off a little bit, that's a freshly dug potato, and you can bet it's going to be very flavorful and unique to what you've probably been eating most of your life.
And what happens to these potatoes over time as they sit? Will the skin get thicker?
The skin will get thicker. That's when you start to see the eyes develop. And by the way, it's fine to store a potato and it grows some eyes. And when you pull it out to eat it, just knock the eyes off and they're fine to eat. Don't eat the eyes. they have a bit of arsenic in them. These potatoes can be stored for up to about 9 months. They will start to lose their flavor a little bit. The skin will get thicker.
And what's your favorite way to cook a new potato that has this really thin skin?
Personally, I'm pretty partial to roasted potatoes. As a farmer, I'm working so many hours a day, and one of us has to do the cooking, either James or myself. So we tend to go for the simpler things. I can take this Yukon Gold. In fact, it's fun to mix the two. I can dice them up, throw them on a cookie sheet, put them in the oven for 20 minutes coated with some olive oil, pull them out, and there's my side dish. You know, make a little salad, a little bit of meat, and I'm good to go for dinner.
Perfect. Well, thanks for all this great information, and I'm excited to try these brand new potatoes.
Thank you so much for talking with us today.
That was Dawn Birch. She and her husband, James, are the farmers behind Florabella Farms up in Three Rivers. You can find them at the Wednesday and Saturday downtown Santa Monica Farmers Market. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can always subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, Gary Masiha, and Paul Smith. I'm Evan Kleiman. Get grilling. I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.